Welcome to the Homestretch Podcast, where we interview world champions, Olympians, amazing people, amazing athletes who have accomplished just amazing things, things that we want to strive for, and we want to learn the points on how to achieve success from their stories. So today, I have another special guest, John Register, joining me today. How you doing, John?
What's up? How you doing? It's great. Great to see you again. Just saw you in Vegas, man. That was great.
Yes. That was my first time at the speakers convention. And it was a great experience. I got to connect with a lot of people, including yourself. So it was definitely worth the trip. And so you have a great story, and I definitely want to dive into it. For those who aren't familiar with John, just a little bit. He was an All-American track and field athlete at the University of Arkansas.
Cool. And
a silver medalist, Paralympic silver medalist in the 2000 Games in Sydney. Man, that had to be amazing.
That's like a lot, right? Because you go from Olympic hopeful to Paralympic medalist, American record holder, and that's just like, what's the story behind that, right? So you got it.
Yeah, I know. That's a story. That's a whole story in itself. But I want to start from the beginning. Because I always like to start with the sports, you know, asking about the sport foundation, because I find that that's where, at least for me, starting in track at a young age, that's where I gained my confidence and esteem. And that's when I started setting goals and seeing a reward. You know, I was able to travel from island to island because of track. And so you started in sports at a very young age. You were a swimmer first.
Yeah, I swam, but I think before swimming, I was actually playing ice hockey.
Hockey? In Chicago.
You know, I was playing hockey, man. It was at Risland Commons pool. I mean, Risland Commons, there was a pool there, but there's ice rink. And I think I did swimming, and it was kind of like the same time. So maybe I was swimming in the summer and then ice hockey in the winter time. But it was an outdoor rink, covered outdoor rink. So if you picture that, so you could actually see the outside, but just like a covered tarp or a hard cover on the top. So yeah, it was pretty cool. You know, my parents just let me play anything really, and just get me involved in the community and get into sport.
Well, I think that's the best way to develop as a kid. I don't think you need to be pigeonholed into one sport. Play as many sports as you can. I can't imagine there are many brothers playing ice hockey though.
No, not no Park. At least I don't remember.
But
I liked it, you know. I just couldn't figure out how to skate backwards. That was my hardest thing. I just never could figure it out for some reason. So my days were numbered. You know, if you can't skate backwards in hockey, man, you just done.
So, yeah, we have a rink here at Cornell, and I haven't tried. I just, you know, we have a really good hockey team. I know I'm gonna hurt myself, so I'm not even gonna try.
Ice is unforgiving for sure.
I'm sure, yeah. Man, no way. I'm good on that. I'm from the Caribbean, so I'll pass. So you started out hockey and swimming, and how did you choose track? How did you get into track and field?
So track, Adrian, was really chosen for me, and this is one of the things I talk about with, you know, parents or youth, and as I coach now, it's really developed my entire coaching philosophy when I'm coaching the young kids and high schoolers and middle schoolers, primarily on the hurdles. It's what you desire to do, and I'm not going to stand in the way of that. So, and here's the story behind it. I was really a great baseball player. I could play baseball. Baseball was like, it came natural to me. I could hit, I could run, I could field, I could throw, I could steal bases. It was everything, right? And so there were two instances that gave me a really sour taste in my mouth. And the first one was the Junior Pony League and the Pony League are two teams, you know, one under the other. And I played Junior Pony in seventh grade, which is cool. You know, that's what you usually do. And then eighth grade, you jump up to Pony. Mm-hmm. So I went to the tryouts in eighth grade for the Pony League team. And I found out in Oak Park that all the teams were pre-selected. I didn't know this at the time, but I'm having one of these stellar tryouts. I mean, I'm hitting everything, fielding everything, throwing folks out at first base from center field. I mean, I had a great tryout. My dad was, you know, at the fence, you know, kind of with his hands on the fence between the chains of the fence. And he's looking at this tryout, like his kid is having this great tryout, but I don't get selected.
So how was that?
I don't get selected. And I found out later the reason why is because you know how when you try out, you got to pay your registration fee. Mm-hmm. And so they had pre-selected all the teams. All they were doing was collecting all the registration fees so they could actually have a travel fund for the team that was pre-selected.
Oh,
so
I see.
That was, yeah, it was just, that was just wrong, right? I didn't know that then. You know, I know it now, but I didn't know that then. And the second thing was I thought I'll play junior pony. That's what I did. Batted over 800, you know, I stole every base, stole home twice, threw people out from center field, like I said. And then I'm walking in the hallway freshman year of high school, and it's like track season is at indoor, and they're about to start playing spring ball. So I want to get my chance to be on the baseball team, because I still love baseball. I still want to do it. I'm a White Sox fan, Southsider from I love the Southsiders in Chicago. But as I'm walking down the hall, I see the baseball coach coming my way. Mm-hmm. Guy named Mr. Kaiser, right? Coach Kaiser. And Coach Kaiser pulls me over. He says, "Hey, I hear you're going to try out for the baseball team." I said, "Yes, you know, yes, sir, coach, you know." And he's won all these, you know, he hasn't won a championship yet, but he's the guy, right? And so I'm really excited. He's pulled me aside, and he says, "Well, I just want to let you know, I'm not going to pick you." I'm like, "What?" That is a visceral. I mean, why? And I'm in my, you know, 13-year-old, 14-year-old self as a freshman in high school, why is a coach telling me that you're not going to pick me? You haven't even seen me. You haven't even seen what I could do on the field. Why would you not pick me? Well, I found out later that one of two stories, the baseball coach and the track coach had seen how fast I was and diverted me to track and field.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But he was saying all these things like, you got to be able to hit and field. It's not just about running fast. I'm like,
you know,
did you not see what I just did in eighth grade? You know, so.
As a track person, I want to be like, great, we got you. We got another good athlete over the track. But I know how much baseball pays, man. So I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing, you know, Adrian, is later on, I told that story. I was doing an event in Hawaii on Oahu for a medical conference. And I had a booth, and I was kind of just explaining the story. We're just chit chatting around the booth. And I told that story to this guy, and he says, mm-hmm. "Oh my gosh, I'm a baseball fan too. And I live on the island. There's some batting cages over, you know, on the other side of the island. Do you want to go?" I said, "Absolutely." But I'd never picked up a bat. You know, it's been 25 years or whatnot. And you know, I got this artificial leg now. And so we go over to the batting cages, get in the 60 mile an hour cage. And within literally 10 balls, I'm hitting the ball, right? Swinging away on the ball.
You still have skills.
He had skills and pitching. I'm not pitching, but switch hit on it. And then I go to like the 90 mile an hour cage. I jump. Let me just see. Cause that ball comes fast at 90 miles an hour.
Yeah.
I couldn't swing away on it, but I could get the bat on the ball, right? I could just kind of swing quarter swing and just kind of hit the ball. And I switched hit on it and kind of do the same thing. So, you know, who knows what could have happened during that. And when we look back in life, that is really the only thing. The injury is not something I look back and say, yeah, which could have been different. The military, I don't think I wish could have been different. The only thing I really wish I might have been able to explore was baseball. Because it was taken from me.
Changes your whole story though. So, you know.
Yeah, that does change those
stories. Yeah, it changes your whole story. So you can't even really, you know.
But that's why I think, you know, with kids and with parents, let them try everything. Let them try their passion. Let them just explore who they are. Because when you specialize too early, then the synapses of the brain, they start to get together. And at 25, you can't unbreak it. They're done. They don't want any more parts to do with it.
Not only that, but how your muscle fibers operate and how they develop depends on the type of activities that you're doing. And even in literature, even though people don't follow the literature, but in the old IAAF stuff, it tells you at a young age, you should not be specializing. No. And in track and field, you should not be giving young kids distance.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be running them for tons and tons of mileage. You should be having them do a lot of change in direction to work on different muscles so that they can develop fully. Jumping, lots of coordination and balance type of things, and fast stuff, fun stuff. You can always build endurance and develop that end, but fast twitch and being fast and explosive and quick, you can ruin it. You can ruin
absolutely. You know, try to run a 100 meters and then come back and run the mile.
Exactly. Like I could always run as a sprinter. I could still run a good 8, but you know, those 8 guys aren't going to come down in the 100.
Oh, no.
So I'm always like, no, don't kill the kids with over specialization. Let them have fun. And not only that, But part of this whole thing, I think, with kids is developing competency in something, right? Getting good at it. That's right. That's how you start making these goals and dreams and all that stuff. You're good at something. You're like, wow. And you have to try different things and fail and figure out what that thing is that you're good at.
Absolutely.
And enjoy doing.
So yeah, so that's my pain story, and that threw me to track and field. And then the rest was wow. I caught the bug, right, in track.
Were you killing it in high school? I'm sure you were.
Yeah, I mean, I was good. I won't say I was killing it. You know, some of the you know, I saw, you know, folks like Mike Conley, right? So he was a couple years ahead of me. Mike Conley, one of the greatest triple jumpers, long jumper, doublers, went to the, you know, Olympic Games and, you know, gold medalist, silver medalist in triple. So you look at somebody like that, and, you know, he won for Luther South High School on the south side of Chicago. He won four events and scored 40 points at the state track meet. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to emulate that. He was 1A. I wanted to do it at 2A. We only had two divisions at that time. I got close, but it wasn't that. And I was doing other events. I was doing like the 300 hurdles, the 110 high hurdles, long jump and triple. Right. And so I think a man did a relay or someone, but I wound up scoring like 19 or 20 points all together. So about half of what he had done, and finished like sixth, the highest finish in our school's history by myself.
Yeah. So I would say you weren't too bad.
I wasn't bad, but I wasn't, you know, I was trying to elevate.
Yeah. You want to be the best.
I want to be the best. Yeah. I just didn't, but you know, then Arkansas did recruit me thanks to the University of Illinois, because I went down there for a recruiting trip. Mm-hmm. And I was about to go to Illinois. I was going to sign with Illinois. And a coach got me in the room and he said, I'll never forget it, man. He said, what do you think about your visit? I said, I love it. It was great. He said, well, I heard you're going to be a trader. I said, what? He said, I heard you're going to take a visit to Arkansas. You're going to be a trader to Illinois? I said, huh? And at that time, I didn't know where Arkansas was. I couldn't point it to you on the map. Mm-hmm. I would have failed geography, right? So I said, well, I started playing what I now know is country dumb. And I said, what does Arkansas have that I don't know about, that I need to know about? So let me keep my mouth closed and go down there and see what they got. And I saw, you know, oh man, Mike's down here. Wallace Spearman's down here. You know, Charles Moss is other guy in Illinois down. I said, shoot, I think I want to go to Arkansas. These were all the people I used to emulate and want to be like. They're there. There was no internet, right? So I couldn't find out where, you know, where people actually went to school. So that was a surprise for me with those two gentlemen down there. And I made the choice to run for the Hogs.
Yeah, it's funny. I interviewed Wallace Spearman Jr. just recently. So he's like, yeah, I'm way faster than my dad.
Dad was a baller, man.
Yeah,
he had a juice.
He's not going to give you that, though.
He had juice, man. He won't give you that, but he had juice. He can roll. Yeah,
no, for sure. And so at Arkansas, you're running in the SEC. I mean, SEC is big time. I ran at South Carolina.
SWC at that time.
Oh, wow. It was.
So we were the only non-Texas school in the state of in Texas. So we had, it was us, Rice, TCU, Baylor, Houston. Who else was in there?
That's a competitive conference.
Oh, my. Texas A&M.
Yeah.
I mean, it was rolling, man. It was like Olympic trials every time you step on the track.
Yeah, no, I mean, that sounds like how the SEC was when I was, still is. So, no, that's
absolutely.
Wild. And so you're a four-time All-American, long jump, 55-meter hurdles, and 4x4.
4x4s, yep.
Woo! Some range.
Well, so we have it was a junkyard relay. You know, because you just
whoever's left standing. Just,
we have 1/4 miler, true quarter miler, and everybody runner, else
a long jumper.
So we have a 3:52 time trial, right? So the time trial, for those that don't know, this time trial, you kind of just see where your conditioning is right before before we went off on winter break, and then we do another one. We come back off winter break to see who actually did the work over the holiday. Yeah. And so I was number 5 on the list for, you know, all the quarter mile, not the quarter miles, but everybody in the time trial. So the 3:52 time trial is, if you add another X number of seconds, that kind of gives you a decent quarter, what you could actually run a quarter in.
Yeah.
So I was number 5. We had a kid hurt in 19, when was it? It was our conference meet. I was done running. I'm up in the stands. I'm chilling. Coach Redwine, Stanley Redwine, who now, you know, Olympic coach for the distance runners and coaches at head coach at Kansas, he comes up and says, "John, I need you to run the mile relay." And remember, I told you this old Southwest Conference. Got Carl Lewis, you got Kirk Baptiste, you got. I don't do that. We got Gabriel Tiako with the 400. These folks are all, you know, Olympians, and no, I don't run four quarters. You know, he said, "We got a kid hurt, and you got to run. You got to run today." And I said, "No, you're the fifth fastest time." "No, I don't do that." So he put me on that team on third leg. Said, "Just keep pace." I cried before I got on the track. I cried afterwards, head pounding, snot coming up my nose. Stanley comes up to me after the race, says, "Well, Big Reg, I got good news for you and I got bad news." So the good news is you just ran your first quarter. You ran 46.5. The bad news is you just made the mile relay team.
Welcome to the 4x4. Welcome to the 4x4.
I said, no.
Yeah.
I should have run 50 seconds.
Yep, that's how it goes. You go out there, split 46.5. Oh, you're permanently on the relay.
Permanently on the relay. So next year we did well. We indoors. I think that was a team that when Michael was just coming in, Michael Johnson was just coming in. Mm-hmm. They were complaining that they had to be in the slow heat with Arkansas Razorbacks. They were mm-hmm. complaining. So we beat Baylor, took first. And then we finished second in indoor, and then outdoor we ran. Our second leg blew up. I ran first leg 45.5 split, and then we finished in 302.29 was our.
Ooh, you guys were rolling, yeah.
We were rolling. It was, yeah, UCLA won that year 3 flat.
Yeah, but 302 is still flying. Oof.
So
yeah. Now that's.
It was fun. No.
Yeah, I remember those days too. I ran on the 4x4 in South Carolina, man. It's, you know, I also remember the days when I didn't want to run and you're like, "Oh, no, nope, you're up.
You're up."
You know, you try everything you can to get out of that 4x4.
Man, it's time to go home, man. I want to. Yeah. Because you know you're going to hurt.
Yeah. And you think being in the stands going to protect you, like coach not going to get you up out the stands just because you got popcorn in your hand or something. Like, nah, warm up.
Warm up. Yeah. Pin relays, I have funnel cake, man. I was eating funnel cakes.
Oh, no. So after a successful collegiate career, you went on to join the military. You spent 6 years in the service in the U.S. Army, part of Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm. So at this point, your experience had been, you know, as a collegiate athlete, which is, I mean, that's a mountain in itself, getting to the point mm-hmm. where you're competing at the Division I level. You know, you're an All-American, you know, so you're at, I mean, this is a high level. How do you feel that was it similar at all to your experience joining the military? Like your experience being an athlete, was it similar in any way?
I think it was a preparation for the mental game that happens inside the military. I joined because the Army has a world-class athlete program. And that program allows a soldier athlete to train 2 years prior to their, prior to Olympic games. Now it's a 4-year cycle. You can actually enlist for it or come in officer. So I was trying to make that program. And my wife, well, girlfriend at the time, my wife, we were pregnant with our first child. And so I was trying to, you know, I needed a job. I just graduated. I'd gone to the Olympic trials and, you know, I was trying to get out of school. So I really didn't do great at the Olympic trials. I made it, you know, first round of the high hurdles. You know, I didn't get out of the rounds for the long jump. So I still had it in me. I still wanted to try to see what I could do. And I thought maybe the military was the pathway to give me like you know how we have sponsorships like a Nike or Adidas or a Puma or whoever it is. I thought the Army could be my sponsor to try to help me accomplish what I wanted to. So there was no guarantees of this, right? I just knew they had this program, and if I could get to my coach, I knew I could give myself a shot and just just train full time. So that was my pathway. The circuit was just kind of coming on board at that time where you could actually run overseas and start making some cash. Mike Conley had started really doing that with Tyson's Foods and trying to open up that whole circuit for that. So it was just developing at that point in time. there was no Diamond League. There was no, none of that stuff that was really going on.
At yeah, no, what you're saying is smart. There wasn't really an avenue to make money. I mean, if you were the guy, then maybe, right. maybe Carl Lewis made money, but just Carl Lewis. Right. You know, it wasn't
everybody.
Yeah, and so.
Or very few.
If you want to be able to continue to train at a high level and pay your bills and not have to work three jobs, then you're going to take advantage of a program and opportunity like that. So that's smart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. And I got in. I made the program. You know, it was great. I went to my first like all Army track and field camp, and they were trying to scare me like, oh, you may not make it. I'm like, I'm the only one left here. Right.
Well, I'm wondering, like, if you're probably the fastest one there.
You don't know, bro. So, and I had already qualified for the USA Track and Field Nationals. So I knew I was going to I just was trying to get myself in shape to run the Nationals, right?
Yeah.
And see what I could do there and then try to get cooked up with a coach so I could actually make a push and a run for I think it was 92 Barcelona. So, so then I said, I like this military thing. This is good. This is a good deal. I was loving the work, I was, kind of respected and honored with inside of it. I was making rank, I took the officer selection battery. I said, I could do this as a career. It really was one of those things that I wouldn't have known about had not I joined.
And see, that's what and that stuff you're mentioning right there. That's what I'm wondering. How similar was just going through that to your experience as an athlete? Because it sounds similar to me when you're kind of going through and progressing and earning rank and proving yourself. And same. It takes a certain amount of discipline and dedication. It feels like the same type of thing to be an all-American type of athlete. So I was just wondering if you felt like it was a similar process or experience.
Yeah, it was a similar process. But again, going through the workouts that we did in Arkansas.
Yeah, yeah.
It was nothing. we're doubled over throwing up, and the only time I threw up in the military was when they put the gas in,
it was cake. It was easy.
It was easy. And I said, man,
there it is, folks.
It was easier than running, you know, the workouts you do.
Hey, listen, one argument, I know for a fact that track training is way harder than football. That's for sure, because everybody who comes out for football is terrified. I mean, I know a lot of guys, they come out for, the football guys who come out for track, they're like, hey, man, I can't, like a 400? A 400. No way, man. No, maybe a 60.
Not one.
And they know track practice is hard, man. Training for a 4, I mean, that's one of the worst things.
You got to die, man. It's just because you have to build the lactic acid and the poison in the muscle to push through it. It's just like, what?
So I tell my athletes, one thing that you could be sure of is that track practice is going to be way harder than any meet you ever go to.
I want
you to feel it here so that when you get to a meet, it's easy.
Right, right. And that's what the military was. It was easy. It was easy in the standpoint of I knew my role. I had the mental capacity to think, even at a heart rate of running fast and on the fast, we're doing our runs or sprints, even if my heart rate was at 140 beats a minute, I could think, because my heart rate was used to being 180 beats a minute.
Yeah. 140.
this is a job, So it wasn't rucking, walking 15 miles. You're not going to break me in that capacity because you can't put the stress on my body like the Razorbacks did. So that was one. But the thing that did kind of, it took me for a loop a little bit was when Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm came up.
Okay.
And that was, I was in school, I was in primary leadership development course. It's the first non-commissioned officer course. So I was trying to make rank. I was trying to become a sergeant. And I needed that course in order to kind of get my points to do that. Uh-huh. And I was also working a job where I was an E4 at the time. So the job was slotted for an E4, actually two E4s. And there were two of us in there, and there were two excess that were E5s that were in there as well. And that was also a loss to the unit because I'm about to go to San Francisco to begin my Olympic training because I qualified for the program. So I was a three-time, what they call winner, because I was non-deployable. I was in school. I'm on PCS orders to go to another station. And I'm working a slot that only is built for my slot. But because I wasn't there, those E5 shafted me, and they said, short draw the stick. You're the one that's going to be representing us going to Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm. So that's how I got to the desert. I was like, I was boohooing.
I know that had to be unexpected, right? You were like, man, I'm trying to run track, and y'all sending me out here like to wars.
So I just had to really, you know, knuckle down and, and say, okay, I need to be, you know, all the training I've had, I need to direct that focus into this campaign because I need to come back. Right. When I came back, you know, I learned a ton over there. Don't get me wrong. It was a fantastic experience. Learned a little bit of Arabic, learned how to, you know, do a lot of what I do like now, like a lot of sports diplomacy globally. So that helped it helped in my speaking. It helped me to understand people and different dialects, different parts of the country, and that the stuff you see on TV is not the stuff that's going on over there, because it's over here is the political spin, over here is the real deal. So it taught me a lot of those things that that I would not have had I not had that experience. But when I came back, I was just the sand just took it out of my legs. I could not run the high hurdles anymore. I was running 13 fives in the highs. So I needed like a couple tenths of a second down. I'm in the hunt, right? I'll be in the hunt. I'm running 14 flat, right? 14-1. It just wasn't great. So I switched events. My coach that taught me the most, his name is Remy Korchimny. And Remy, he kind of wrote the book on sprints and hurdles in the United States. So he really took me under his wing and began. I ran a quarter up at the track in Reno when I was training, and just to do a time trial on it. And I came in again like at 46.8 indoor. And he said, "That's it. We're switching events. You run the 400-meter hurdles."
Yeah.
And so that was a switch. And in my fifth race ever, I qualified for the trials. In my sixth race, I finished 17th in the trials and in the United States. And I said, "That's my race. I got it. I'm going to do another 4 years. I'll re-enlist again, and I'm going to drive for 1996 Atlanta." I figured that would be my games. It would be my prime. And I knew the race. I became a student of the 400-meter hurdles. I transitioned to Germany in the military, and I started running track at local track clubs and training with the Germans, training. I got another coach that was over there, but also still in contact with my coach. And we just put it down. And when I came back in 1994, to run all Army track and field and try to get back on the Army's world-class athlete program again, I had gone from the 50.30 that I had done in my sixth race down to 49.80. So I was on track, right? I was starting to come.
Yeah, you started to move.
I was starting to roll. Yeah. And I could see it, right? I said, I knew the mental game. I said, I don't need to chase all these guys and try to run the 48s now. What I need to do is at the end of 1994, I need to be around 49.4. And at the end of 1995, I need to be around 49 flat, 48.8. And at the end of, and then with trials coming around, I'll be ready to run my 48.5s, right? Yeah. And that'll put me in the hunt. That'll put me in the hunt.
Yep.
So that was my plan, right?
That was the game plan. Just
follow the plan.
Yeah.
You know, I was at five hurdles at 13 steps in year number one. Year number two, I went 13 steps through six.
Oh, no, that's legit. You were on pace.
So I was on pace, right? Yeah. I figured if I could do, I don't know if I would have got the seven, but I was trying to get six easy, six comfortable, switch, and then coming hard, blazing on the last hundred. So that was kind of my methodology in my head. I thought if I went to seven hurdles, I wouldn't have enough gas to get through to run the, I'd be too tired to close the race.
Yeah, solid strategy. And so that was your plan. And you're going to make the Olympic team and you go out there and you're going to chase this medal in the four hurdles.
Absolutely.
And so sometimes we make plans and life just throws us a little bit of a curveball.
Yeah.
And so your curveball at this time was?
So I was training as part of the Army's world-class athlete program. I'm in Hays, Kansas. I'm on leave or temporary duty from Germany now. So I'm now back in the United States. My wife and I have been separated as geographically because I did not have command sponsorship. So my family had to stay in the States while I served my duty tour over in Germany. So she's working a job there. I come back to the States. And so we're now we can talk on the regular. But I'm in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and I'm running, and I've just run that 40-49-80 race. And so I'm blazing. I'm ready for the next one. See if I can do it again. Can I repeat the performance? Get within a couple tenths of a second of it. And we go to Hays, Kansas, which is in the middle of Kansas, Fort Hays State University. And I'm doing a shakeout on the track. And for those, I'll kind of break down. Let me just break down the 400 meter hurdles. It's one time around the track. It's over 10 obstacles spaced 35 meters apart. There's a 45 meter lead into the first hurdle and a 40 meter runoff of the last hurdle, the 10th hurdle to the close. Usually a hurdler would take about 21 steps to the first hurdle from the blocks to the first hurdle, and then 13 steps, as we talked about earlier, down the backstretch. So that was I was doing that for the first three hurdles. And I'm approaching every hurdle at the speed of about 8.9 meters per second, which equates to really fast. Well, it equates to about almost 20 miles an hour, 19 and a half to 20 miles an hour. So the wind's blowing really hard in Hays, Kansas, and I'm having problems with my steps. I'm getting 21 steps, 22 steps to the first hurdle. So that means I'm going over with my right leg, or it comes up with the left leg. I got to take it with my left leg. And I'm ambidextrous. I can do it with any leg. It doesn't really matter. But in hurdles, as in life, you just want things to stay the same. Same thing with the 13 steps for the second hurdle. I'm getting 13 steps and 14 steps because of the wind. And same thing with the third hurdle, 13 steps, 14 steps with that. So I'm like, man, can I just get one consistent? So I get back in the blocks. And I said, I'm going to, no matter the wind, I'm going to push through this one because I want to set the race to try to be consistent for the next day. So I get in the blocks, jump out of the blocks, 21 steps to the first hurdle, I'm on. Second hurdle, 13 steps to the second hurdle, right leg leads, I'm on again. And I feel that Kansas wind push against me. But I really push back against the Kansas wind this time, and I realize about six steps out, I'm going to be short and have to take with my left leg. No problem. Off the right leg, go across the hurdle with my left leg. When I land, I hear, and my body sails and twists in the air, and I see my left shin pass in front of my face. My shoulders hit the ground, and I bounce to a halt. I do a quick once in my body. I look at my shoulders. Shoulders are okay. My waist is okay. When I see my knee has risen up. The patella has risen up 3 inches up my femur bone. My left leg is now canted across my right leg, and my foot's touching the black surface of the track. It was devastating. And before the injury, before everything kind of really starts and the pain sets in, you have this kind of moment, right? This moment of what just happened. It's kind of this bewildering moment. And I want to, if I can get it up, I would like to show you a picture of the injury that day. So I want to see if I can just kind of share the screen. If you give me sharing rights, I want to share the screen and just kind of show the folks there what's going on in this photograph. And so you can see, let's see here. Oh, that's a chat box. I can't do that. There's not gonna be a chat. So as I'm laying on the ground, I have I don't know if it's gonna work. I'm not sure if it's gonna work.
Should.
Okay,
now,
there we go.
Now we can edit it in. We can add it so folks could see it.
Oh man.
So if you look at the right, you see my foot's on the ground and you see the head of the femur trying to push out from the knee. And my knee is actually where that gentleman's hand is, with the fingers pointing down.
Oh my goodness.
In my head, you see that I have a very calm look on my face, but I have a fist. My fist is
that fist is balled up.
Is balled up, right? So I'm in tremendous pain, but I'm trying to remain relaxed, right?
Yeah.
So that's the pain of like the quarter mile. You are in pain, but you want to look relaxed through it, right?
Yeah, you definitely have a pain tolerance.
The pain tolerance, right? So you have Dino Napier, who he ran for LSU. He ran 2011 in the Olympic trials in 96. Mm-hmm. Ben Curitan, I'm supposed to go to officer candidate school with him. He's in the white shirt looking backwards, cradling underneath my head. And Tony Sylvester with the white ball cap and the glasses, he's a combat medic. And so he knows exactly what to do. He saved over, you know, tens lives over in Iraq and Afghanistan. So they know what to do, but I'm in a bad state. And the only thing I can think about at that time is just get up. Just get yourself up. But there's no way, right? Everything's gone. I just wanted to not be like this because I've just run a 49.8. I'm on the trajectory to make the Olympic team. You know, I'm going to officer candidate school. My whole life is before me. And so they whisked me over to Hayes Medical Center. They reduced my knee, which means they popped it back in place. The legs swelled up. I passed out. And 7 days later, I wake up. Well, I'm in and out, but 7 days later, I'm faced with one of the toughest decisions where my wife, Alice, is holding on my left hand. My parents on the opposite side of the bed, little John Jr., he's 5.5 years old, playing with a little toy truck, little toy train at the bottom of the foot of the bed. And Dr. Randy Mullins comes in the room and says, "Yeah, John, you got a tough choice to make. You can keep your leg and use a walker or a wheelchair for the rest of your life, or I can amputate your leg and you can use a prosthesis for the rest of your life."
Man.
Yeah, what kind of choice is that?
Yeah, that's a choice. I mean, you know, you're at the peak of your game, and then just like that, and you know, it's crazy because when I talk to people, the more people I talk to who have similar stories, it always happens just like that. You know, it's like you're at the top of your game, and you don't expect anything like that to happen, and all of a sudden, bam, and you're faced with the toughest decision of your life. I'm sure. I can't even imagine being confronted with a decision like that.
It was hard in a way, but also easy, right? It was. I think it's the acceptance first. Once I accepted that, yeah, there's no way I'm going to the Olympic Games, you know, there's no way to recover from this type of injury. The doc says my legs gonna be fused, my knee's not gonna be able to bend, except for like 15 degrees, and probably have to take an amputation later in life. It was pretty quick. The decision was I was in so much pain. There was the pain that spoke first. So I said, if I can just get rid of my male deductive reason, said, if I just get rid of the leg, I'll get rid of this pain.
So that's real pain right there.
Yeah,
that's real pain when you're like, "Hey, look, just get rid of it.
Just get rid of it." It was tremendous. I mean, I'd never felt nothing like that before, right? Yeah. Heart rates at like racing at 135 all the time. So I'm glad I was in great shape because if I was overweight or wasn't in shape, and 135 is a stressor, right? But for me, that's my resting almost, heart rate before I start another resting. Run.
Yeah, that's recovery. My recovery. I would be ready for another run at 120.
Yeah, like that was 120.
Right. As far as my coach was concerned, I was fully recovered at 120.
Fully recovered. Right. 120, you're good. When I'm tired of the kids to do this,
yeah,
you know, 6 seconds. Let me know when you get. So they're like,
yeah,
they try to lie on me now, right? So because the pulse doesn't lie. So
and so your injury,
yeah,
you hyperextended your left knee, and and from what I looked at, resulted in a severed. Okay, I don't think I could pronounce it.
Popliteal.
Okay, there we go. Yeah. And you're on one of the arteries. And that led to you developing gangrene in the leg?
Right, because the arteries, you know, they take blood away from our heart to the organs and the places that we need it, right? So with that artery severed and broken, there was no blood flow going to the lower portion of my leg. And so the leg just started dying.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Because there's no oxygen going to it.
Yeah.
And so it goes real fast. Think about how fast our brains will go if there's no oxygen going to the brain. It just starts immediately. It starts dying. So my physicality was trying to protect itself. So it was shutting things down to try to preserve what it could preserve. So that's really kind of another thing that kind of, you know, saved me. So
you make this big decision and now, where are you from here? Because, you know, some folks are going to be in a rut for a long time. I mean, that's, you know, it could be like, look, I'm done. Or you could have a completely different approach and be like, you know what? This is what I have, but I'm choosing my own path. These are cards that were dealt, and I'm going to take them, and I'm going to do this with it or do that with it, or I can still accomplish this. So what was your next move, or where was your mental state at that point?
Yeah, it was a both and. For sure, you know, I think a lot of things in my life had led up to this moment. So I wasn't in the like despair, but I did have my night, what I called my night in Gethsemane. So I'm a believer, Christ. And so I believe that not just things that happen for a reason, not just that, but there was things I was doing in my life that led up to this point in time, which people were watching. How am I going to come through this? Because I'm saying one thing, and will my actions in this time of testing actually equate to what I was living or said I was living? So we don't know what we would do until we actually get into a test. We think we know what we're going to do, but we don't know until the test actually comes. Our character is who we are when no one's watching. Yes. Our character also is what we stand for when everyone is watching. And our character is actually revealed during our times of testing. So this was a test. And, you know, and a lot of people heard on the track when I heard the leg snap that the first word out of my mouth was hallelujah. I don't remember it. This was an eyewitness. These were eyewitness accounts of people that were around me when it happened. So there was something on the inside of me that came out during my time of testing that was aligned with who I said I was prior to that moment. So that's the first thing. The second thing is I did have my downward spiral. So let's not get it twisted. It wasn't all rainbows afterwards, right? I went down this downward spiral because when I woke up from that surgery, I was in a hospital room, 11 o'clock at night. I'm by myself. My wife's not around. I don't know where anybody is. And I was in more pain than my male deductive reasoning had reasoned. And I wanted something to knock it out. So there's a morphine drip button over here. I'm too weak to roll over to depress the button. But there's a nurse's aid station out there. I can see them outside my door, but those tubes that have been down my throat made the sound too inaudible to get their attention. So there I lay in that bed for the next 8 hours with my dangerous thoughts. Who am I now? What's my identity? Will my wife still stay with me? My son still see me as his father? Do I still have a job in the military? Can I support my family? I mean, my Olympic dreams are over. At 8 o'clock, Dr. Mullins, he comes back in the room, sees I've done a 180-degree shift in my countenance. I'm on this downward spiral path really fast. So he immediately calls my wife, Alice, God bless her, who's over at the hotel trying to manage herself, John Jr., her mother-in-law. The doctor and nurses told her to go home because she had been with me all that time. They said I would sleep through the night. I didn't. And she just found out at 7 o'clock that morning that the job she was working at in West Memphis, Arkansas has just fired her because she's been gone too long taking care of me. And this saint of a woman comes over, takes them 45 minutes to get me out of the bed, into a wheelchair, wheeled out to an inaccessible playground where I'm parked in front of the little gravel, watching my wife and my son play on the swings. And I couldn't push myself out of that chair. It was the first time I felt devalued, dejected, and disabled. I lost it, started crying uncontrollably, heaving sobs and sighs. And Alice saw me struggling. She comes running over and says, "What is going on?" And I began to articulate to her everything that was in my head the night before. And that's when she said the words that really stopped my downward spiral. It was like a gift from God. This angel comes and says, "We're going to get through this together. It's just our new normal." And when she spoke those words, she baselined me, man. She baselined me. And I began to kind of, you know, wipe the tears away from my eyes. And I see John Jr. He jumps off the swing, comes running over, says, "Mom, Dad, you see my big jump? Mom, Dad, you see my big jump?" And he jumps between Alice and myself. And he's just validated me as his father. He's just created his new normal. That's what I had to do. And from there, it was all about building. It wasn't going to be easy, but the decision was made that we were going to get through this, no matter how bad it was going to get. And it was going to get a lot worse before it got better. You know, we make our choices. We think that once we get to the other side, we made a commitment that's going to be easy. No, that's when the work begins. When you commit, we've been on the quarter mile theme. You commit to run the quarter, it's going to hurt before you finish. It's going to hurt worse. So that's what I committed to. I committed to the process of getting better day by day.
Wow. One thing you mentioned and one thing I'm realizing here in this is none of us can do it alone.
No,
none of us. Every single person I've spoken to you hearing your story, there is always somebody who's there that has the belief that you can achieve the thing that you want to achieve. And, you know, whether it's interviewing Lashinda Demus and his her mother, or LaShawn Merritt, you know, his mother, you know, even in the times when they're at their lowest, somebody who's there who's like, oh, you're not quitting. You know, right. You're going to do Siobhan Nieto and her husband, Jamie Nieto. You know, he was an Olympic high jumper and he was paralyzed. And,
right.
You know, I guess they had set some goals. You know, they said he wasn't going to walk again, and he had set some goals, and he had made it to like 150 steps. And she's like, okay, now let's go to 300. You know, it was just like always somebody there who's like, and so that's, you know, and we can be that person for somebody.
Yes.
So I like acknowledging that there is this always somebody there. And even if you haven't found that person in your life, you can be that somebody who believes in somebody enough to motivate them, to help
that's
push
right.
them. And it could just be a little belief, as simple as you just saying that one statement that you'll remember for the rest of your life, you know?
And absolutely.
We'll get through this together. So that's amazing. And another thing that you said, was a point that you said earlier on, and I was thinking about it. Yes, you do get tested in life where you get to really see if you're that person that you say you are, but right. there's nothing like the pride that you feel when you are that person.
So right.
whatever principle or philosophy that you say that you govern or live your life by, when you prove that it's true and you do believe this and you will stand by this and you will, this is how you're going to live. I think that's probably very fulfilling, or, you know, and rewarding.
Yeah. And I think God knows it's a driver for me. It's not a validation as, you know, the life. It's more what I call echo moments. Mm-hmm. And so ripples will go out from us. So we, you know, you're a speaker, Adrian, you give so much great wealth to the universe and to the world. And you're doing this podcast, which is just opening up so many lives to people. And so you're creating impacts, and those impacts is like a boulder going in the water, and it ripples out. But the waves will hit something and they'll start coming back to you. And we, you know, in sonar location, you have dolphins and mammals in the water. They use echolocation to find out where they are. Where's the food source? So they put out sonar and it comes back to them. So a course corrects them. And then you have blind athletes or people who are blind. They use echolocation as well to know how large a room is, how small a room is, you know, how, you know, where they are in time and space, because they use other senses besides sight. We also can do this, the same thing, when we hear what's coming back to us from external sources that we never knew were actually listening to us, right? Case in point, a woman she went through a double mastectomy because she saw a television show I was on. And she said, if I could go through this and come back and, you know, run again and win again, she could undergo that. Her partner that was in the, not a partner, but her bunk mate, you know, decided not to do whatever the procedure was. And she didn't make it. She passed away. This woman calls me out of the blue and says, your story changed and saved my life.
It gave her the courage to go through with it.
Gave her the courage. And I didn't even know this lady, right? There's a longer story to that, but that's a course correction. That's a course correction. It tells us we're on the right path. That the things that we're doing, what follows after us, is good fruit. It's producing in other people's lives, and that's what we want to see, right? I can look at somebody's life and see what's following after them, and tell what kind of life they're living.
Yeah,
just by what's following after them. So yes. It's a powerful, kind of metaphor of these echoes that push us to the right direction we want to be.
I have a buddy who, when things start going badly in life, he's like, oh man, I must be living wrong, because that stuff is coming back, you know?
It starts coming back.
I know you said you have to go pretty soon, but I just, you know, we get to this point in your story where you went ahead with the amputation.
Yeah.
And in 1996, you were able to make the Paralympic team and you competed in the 50 meter freestyle in swimming. And then you came back in 2000 and competing in the Paralympic Games in track and field in Sydney, Australia. You won the silver medal in the long jump and you broke the American record jumping 17 feet 8 inches. And you got fifth in the one and the two. So, I mean, you know, so I wanted to just get that out because we're only at this point in your story, and we could talk for another hour from this point to everything.
We got a few more minutes.
Everything that you experienced from the start of your recovery to becoming a silver medalist and American record holder. It's like you've lived so many lives in one life, you know, becoming an NCAA athlete, you know, being in the military, and then, you know, going through this low point, this rock bottom, facing this crazy decision where you'll never think you'll be an Olympic athlete again, and then becoming an Olympic athlete in two sports and breaking an American record. So all of that shows, you know the keys to being successful in this life. You know, there are certain things that are consistent that you have to do. And before you go, you got to tell us, you know, if you could just leave, and you've already left some amazing gems, but if you could just lay it out, you know, what does it take? If you want to be successful, if you have a goal, if you have a dream, what does it take to achieve that or even to just pursue it?
So I'm gonna tell the folks, I'm gonna be a little bit late. I got to break this one down. So remember, Alice tells me this is just our new normal. So part of what I chat about now, and we always are evolving, right? The Olympic motto is swifter, higher, stronger. Those words are not written in the superlative of the word. It's not swiftest, highest, or strongest.
Yes.
It's written with an ER stem ending that, you know, Adrian, you can be the swiftest today. You can be swifter tomorrow. You know, you can jump the highest today, jump higher tomorrow. You can lift the heaviest weight today, lift heavier weight tomorrow. So there's always this, what's your ER stem ending is what I always challenge people with. What are you living in the ER for? And for me, it began, okay, let me just not try to win a medal, not try to make a Paralympic team. I didn't even know what the Paralympic Games were. It was, let me stand on my good foot for 15 seconds.
Yeah.
Then it was, let me stand on it for 30 seconds. Much like, you know, you're talking about the high jumper going for 150 steps. And then let's push to 300. So it's these incremental things of saying, I got to get that success. And now I can build upon that little brick and start building the foundation of where I want to go. But we often will say, We'll stay in fear. And there for me, it's not really the fear of what we think. It's, the fear was not me having an amputated leg. And the fear was not me saying Alice is going to leave me. That's not my fear. My fear is, will I still belong? Am I still desirable for my wife? Does my son still value me in such a way that I belong to him still? That's what we fear. We fear that belonging would be taken away. We can look at, you know, America right now, right? People are freaking out because they don't think they belong, or they don't want to lose that sense of belonging.
Yeah.
Other people believing for me or believing for us what we can or cannot do, which is based on what they believe they could or could not do if they were in our situation. And then society. Was it my belonging coming because I watched the Walt Disney movie with Captain Hook? Captain Hook's an above the wrist amputee. He's dark. He's mysterious. He's got this weird looking mustache. He's scaring the Lost Boys in the movie Peter Pan. But wait a minute, I'm an amputee now. Do I see myself from this same lens? Yeah. How many movies do we look from society that tell us who to fear? Right? We see it all the time. So then how do we move out from it? And this is kind of where I want to, the big thing of how we move out from it. How do we sustain? Because people used to ask me, how did you overcome it, John? How did you overcome? And that's a deep question. That is a hard question to answer. And so for the course of, you know, 7 years, 8 years, I tried to answer that question. And I finally got at least a start of a pathway, a start of a journey that worked for me. Now, psychologists will say, you know, it'll kind of go along with some other psychologists, what they say. But this is what happened. I started swimming for physical therapy. So I began doing something, right? I began aggregating and pushing and agitating and putting the body back and putting stresses on the body again from a positive physical standpoint. And I thought I was rebuilding. But I said, had I overcome the amputation of my left leg, I'd have my leg back. It wasn't rebuilding the old life, even though I thought I was doing it. That's an old foundation. It's gone. You can't pour old wine into new wineskins. The wineskins will burst. So you have to have a total new way of looking at it. That's what Alice said, the new normal. New is no prior point of reference. What are the rituals you put in place that lead us to a rhythm, that elevate us to a rise, that create the results that we need to have in our lives? That's the normal. That's the normality of what we're trying to get to. And those things can shift a bit when we get put under duress and stress. So now I'm at the second level, right? I've gone from this redefining rebuilding to a redefining moment. The redefining moment is I have a glimpse, just a little glimpse of what the future might hold for me, a little positivity that's in there from all this work that I've been doing on this false summit, this false narrative that I'm on, trying to build on this false foundation. And that little bit of glimpse is, I think I can be a little bit better. I think there's a light at the end of the tunnel. I can't see it, but I think it's there. And that becomes the truth that I begin to hold on to. And when our truth outweighs the fear that we've been in, we'll commit to a courageous life. We'll make the commitment. So we get the commitment now, and the jump, we have to own it. The jump is our jump. And that's the release. I got to release from the fears that I've been in to get to the other side. And I won't do it if my truth does not outweigh the fear. If the fear is over the truth, I'll never commit to it. I'll stay in the bad relationship. I'll stay in that bad job. I won't move because of what other people are going to say about me. I'm going to storm the Capitol on January the 6th because I don't know everybody else is doing it. So I'm going to jump in there too. We don't have our own voice and we can't articulate the fears that we actually have. But if we're courageous, enough, we won't have to live in that fear where I have to justify my actions of why I'm not courageous. I can jump to the rebirth. And the rebirth, we think, is going to be easy. I've committed. I'm on this rebirth. I feel great about myself. However, I got to learn everything all over again. I have to unlearn some things in order to learn. That's why we can't get over race relations in this country. Because we have to unlearn some things that we were taught. And we don't want to do the work. Because we're going to stay in our fears, what other people think about us, or what society says about us. But if I commit to it, now I can do the unlearning and I can begin to build the process. For me, like I said, I had to stand on my good leg for 15 seconds and then manipulate my way, a wheelchair, to get to prosthetic appointments. And then from prosthetic appointments, putting on an artificial leg to a 4-bar walker to walk around the hospital. And then 4-bar walker to crutches, crutches to a cane, cane to free walking to swimming, swimming to running, running to jumping, jumping to a silver medal. That's 6.5 years it took. But when I get there, I now have a resolve about myself. I know exactly who I am. I know exactly how I'm showing up. And no more am I going to go back to the fears that other people might have or society dictates to me. No, you need to catch up to where I am. And that's not braggadocio. That's just, I know who, I've done the work. I know who I am now. I've unlearned to learn. And when I get there, that's when people say, hey, I want to be like that guy. Because he's got his stuff together. He's not with all these wishy-washy people over here just following the crowd. He's claimed, made his own stake in the sand, right? So, or on the foundation. So that then equals our liberation. It's our freedom that we can now live this free life. And there are multiple jumps we have to take. I know that. But the freedom jump is not for us. We think it is until we say we see somebody else back there in their fear. And now we want to bring them along the pathway and leave legacy to build somebody else. But the jump, to make no mistake, the jump is their jump. So that's what happened. I started swimming for physical therapy. I got so fast in the water that I somehow fluked up, messed up, and made the Paralympic swim team.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm getting from this. I'm hearing you, and it's like, start doing the work.
Start doing the work.
And as you're doing the work, you'll start seeing glimpses of where it could go.
Right.
And then, so that becomes your truth. And you do enough work to where that overcomes the fear that's holding you back.
Yeah,
that's what I got from what you said. So you got to start doing the work.
You got to start doing the work, and you know, then you'll start getting at that truth, right?
Yeah. So you just started rehabbing. All of a sudden, you're flying. You're like, whoa, okay. Now I'm seeing an opportunity, an option, right, that wasn't there before.
Absolutely.
Now there's something else that's obtainable because you started with the work. So I like that.
You start the work. And now you, so now I get this, the swim. So I'm there at the Atlanta at the swim. I'm supposed to be on the 400 meter hurdles.
yeah.
I'm swimming.
Yeah.
And the most beautiful thing that happened during that whole process, Adrian, is when the 400 meter hurdles went off for the Olympic trials, I was walking along the upper deck because I had some athletes there in the Army's world-class athlete program. I was now a sports specialist working, helping them get there. So as I'm walking, those that had not qualified for the finals, they're in the stands. They're all sitting together. And they called me up to come sit with them to watch the 400 meter hurdle finals. Best moment, one of the best moments of my life.
Wow. Yeah.
Man. They honored me for the belonging. We know that you were on this pathway. We know that you probably were going to be in that finals down there, right? So come watch with us, right? We're you're still part of our community. You still belong. It was absolutely beautiful, right? So then I see athletes running and jumping in Atlanta on artificial limbs. I said, what am I doing in the swimming pool? I need to be back on the track. That's where that's my juice. That's there. You know, so I had a leg made for running, relearned how to run, relearned how to jump. And then 4 years later, won the silver medal in the long jump, set the American record at 5'41", like you said, 17.8. And the world record at the time was like 17.8½. So a centimeter, just like a centimeter over. So the world record holder had to break his world record, tie it or break it to beat me that day. Right. So I pushed him. I pushed him because you never count out the gold medalists ever, ever. But I'm gunning for you. That's for sure. Right. I'm gunning for you. And he knew it. And so he had to pull out the best jump of his life to win that, you know, to repeat as champion. So that's, you know, and I'm okay with that. Right. That's he earned gold. I earned silver. The other guy earned bronze. And I'm totally fine with that because I gave my best performance. I laid everything out I had, and I did it within inside of 3.5 years. So, you know, so I have no regrets. And in fact, I was just headed out. You know, I got silver, right? You know, somebody's right there.
Okay, now you got a floss. Yeah, no.
Flossing.
Yeah. Rock the medal. I love it.
Mark, we were at the White House. Mark Criar, you know, Mark Criar from he ran hurdles that he won silver at the Sydney Games as well. He had busted his arm and won silver. So we're at the White House. He showed me his silver medal. I showed him mine because we ran hurdles against each other when we were in college. Oh, wow. And he said, man, you got all the decorations on the back. We only got that, you know, on our medal. You can see the decoration and stuff.
Yeah, you had a fancy one.
I had a fancy one. He wanted to switch. I said, no, bro, you got to lose a leg for this one.
Oh, man, yeah. Nah, the real medal right there.
This one take work.
incredible story. And you're still doing, you know, you're still doing things. You don't stop moving. You're a peer mentor, no. Working with the military and the veteran hospitals. You know, you serve on a bunch of boards. You know, you're one of the 35 co-chairs who acted as a surrogate for President Obama's 2012 reelection. You know what I mean? You're in a position with the USOC. And you birthed the USOC Paralympic Military Program, which uses sports to assist in the recovery of wounded, ill, or injured service members. So, I mean, you just, you know, you found your purpose and you're out there just passing along the message. You're supporting folks. I mean, it's a beautiful story. It's something to aspire to. Absolutely.
Well, I can say the same thing about you. You know, you're flowing. It's great to see the work that you're doing. And how you are just, you know, encouraging and just uplifting humanity. These are, you know, great stories, great sessions to really the voices needed in the world because we see so much negativity, and you're lifting it. You're pushing in that space and to provide a light.
No, I appreciate it. You know, like I said earlier, we can all be that person for somebody. And if one person listens to this episode and hears your story, and because they saw this podcast on YouTube or iTunes or they heard it, they're able to go out there and overcome something or conquer something. You know, they may be at the bottom and they just need that little bit of push to hear someone say, hey, you can do it, man. You can, like, come on, you know, find your truth, make that truth, do the work, let that truth outweigh that, overcome that fear.
Right.
You know, let's get it. And so if I can do that by doing this and get to speak to some amazing people and hear some great stories, then you know, I'm gonna do what I can.
Yeah, this when I was just thinking about, was that, was it Drake? What's that? Started from the bottom, now we're here.
Yeah, you know it is, man. You can keep it moving, like you said. You can get from here to there and just keep progressing. So
yeah,
that's what I'm gonna try to do.
Anyone can do it, you know. Just gotta find your purpose and just roll with it. Just go.
And that's the thing. Anyone can do it. We can all take it. Doesn't matter.
You can all do it.
Not everyone's gonna win the gold medal.
Right.
But if you start the journey, wherever you end up is further than where you started.
That's right.
So
you just got to start. Just start.
Just start. Don't be afraid.
Don't be afraid. It's just start. Just go.
Well, I appreciate it, John. I appreciate you coming on and taking the time to tell your story. It was great. We definitely have to do this again sometime.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Sure. So thanks again. And we'll talk soon. Take care.
Absolutely. Blessings to you.
All right. Take care, John.
All right. Bye.